and his previous promises to the nation of Israel. And these covenants were made through Abraham, Moses, and David. So we see in the short term in this book that the God's people must suffer consequences for breaking that covenant. But God hopes to restore the covenant with his remnant and those people that are going to remain with him and be faithful to him. And we see the covenant faithfulness of the people must include justice and mercy and faithfulness. And we're going to see that in the key verse in chapter 6, verse 8, kind of what God expects of his people as they approach him. And finally, they are historians or interpreters of Israel's history. So without their interpretation of God, God's people would not know why a specific event was occurring. So a couple of examples of that from the perspective of Micah. Through Micah, we can understand why the city was under siege at this time. We can understand why Hezekiah was trapped like a bird in a cage, and yet why was Sennacherib, why was he defeated amidst all of that? And then we can also see ultimately what happens to those who are willing to remain faithful to God. And so looking quickly at the timeline, we're in the time of Micah, which is, you know, he preached approximately 735 B.C. to 700 B.C. And he worked in the reigns of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, who were kings of Judah. And we see that in chapter 1. So just to give you a little bit of background on these three kings, and I think Danny did a pretty good of covering this as well in his previous classes, but Jotham, he was a good man who followed in the ways of Uzziah. As king of Judah, he served around 750 B.C. to 732. He was 25 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned for 16 years. And there was a lot of good things that happened during his reign. He was kind of known for his building projects, his material prosperity, and his military successes. Ahaz, on the other hand, he was a very evil king. He was unusually evil, and especially when you compare him to many of the other kings of Judah. He served around 735 B.C. to 715 B.C. And Ahaz was the son and successor of Jotham. And he was also the father of Hezekiah. So he was kind of surrounded on each side by good kings. And yet he was evil beyond any of the other kings. And he really he practiced some of the worst idolatrous practices that we see in the Old Testament. In 2 Kings 16, verse 3, starting in verse 3, it says, "But he walked in the way of the kings of Israel. He even burned his son as an offering, according to the despicable practices of the nations whom the Lord drove out before the people of Israel. And he sacrificed and made offerings on the high places and on the hills and under every green tree." And it also says in 2 Kings 16, "He even placed an altar made from a Syrian model in the temple." And so I think that Danny said it pretty well in his previous class. He was kind of a king that would serve, you know, any idol anywhere, anyone other than Yahweh, the true God. And then Hezekiah, he was a very good king. He was the son and successor of Ahaz. He began his reign when he was just 25 years old, and he reigned from around 715 to 686 B.C., and around his time in history, this is a time when Assyria had really kind of risen to the peak of its power. But he was really known for a lot of his religious reforms. A few examples of that, he cleansed the temple from idols, and he restored temple worship. We see that in 2 Chronicles 29. He also destroyed many of the altars to the heathen gods. He destroyed the serpent of Moses, which had become sort of worshipped by the people. The feasts and the sacrifices were kept, and the priests sanctified themselves, and he organized the priests and the Levites. You know, he organized them to continue with the religious services that they were expected to go through. And his acts of righteousness were seen by God. He was very ill around 701 B.C., but God answered his prayer and extended his life for 15 additional years. And he also delivered Hezekiah from Assyria And we'll talk a little bit more about that, how he was trapped in a cage, and yet he was delivered from that. But Micah, he was perhaps not too impressed by some of these reforms, just based on kind of what we read in Micah. We don't really read a lot of positive things about the people. It might have been because it had become very routine for the people to worship God. We'll see that in chapter 6, where the people are wondering, you know, what kind of sacrifices do they have to make to God? Do they have to, you know, offer their firstborn to him? And Micah's response is, no, you just need to have justice and love mercy. So the people, I don't think that they were fulfilling the requirements that were expected by God, and their heart really wasn't in the worship. So there wasn't any reform deeply embedded in their hearts. So moving on to kind of where we are in the book geography-wise. And so I kind of like this map because it shows you the geography and kind of where Micah fits in with that. So today we're going to be in chapters 4 and 5, so I'll highlight a couple things on the map that we are going to be seeing in those chapters and in the rest of the book as well. So there's going to be some mention of Jerusalem at the very beginning of chapter 4. And then in chapter 5, we're going to see the coming of the Messiah in his birthplace, which is going to be in Bethlehem, which is just south of Jerusalem. And then in the next class, we're going to see God. He's going to use the example of Balak, king of Moab, and the story of him and Balaam in defense of his faithfulness as he's kind of building his case against the people and building his case for his faithfulness. And so Moab, you'll see on the map, is to the south east of the Dead Sea there. So I want to quickly just talk about some of the key themes that we're going to see in this book. The character of the sovereign God and the sins of the people demand judgment. And so God's judgment comes forth in the form of an oppressor, which is going to be Assyria, and then Babylon, which we'll hear a little bit about in the book as well. And God is going to judge them also by means of the curses, which were mentioned in the book of Deuteronomy. A second theme here is the shepherd king is going to gather and deliver a remnant. So this deliverer is going to be the Messiah, functioning as the new David, and he's going to actually come from the very place that is under Assyrian control at the time of Micah. Third thing that we're going to see is covenant faithfulness must include justice, mercy, and faithfulness. And this is going to be a key verse that we see in chapter 6, verse 8. And kind of the point of this verse is that our worship of God must not purely be in ritual and sacrifice, but it has to be it has to come from the heart. It has to be a proper expression and true worship. A fourth thing that we'll see in the book is that the Lord is the focus of the worship, and we should worship Him alone. And so we'll see in these coming chapters that the nations are no longer going to flow to all the idols that are out there, but rather they're going to flow to the mountain of the house of the Lord. And they're going to go to the one true God, and that one true God is going to offer them peace and prosperity because of that. Another thing that we're going to see is God's grace overcomes the sentence of sin. And so we know that God's faithfulness flows from His steadfast love, and His forgiveness is grounded in His faithfulness to His promises that He's made to us. And then finally, a final thing that we're going to see is God's saving acts in the past, and He's going to provide examples of that, such as Exodus or the story of Balak and Balaam. Those stories are going to foreshadow His saving acts in the future, and we'll see kind of a hint at a remnant in these chapters. So I kind of want to talk about just the structure of the book and where we are. So you can kind of think of this in three sermons. You see that each of them start with the word "here." So the first one, "Hear, you peoples, all of you." The second one, "Here, you heads of Jacob and rulers of the house of Israel." And the third one begins again with the word "here." The first sermon is chapters 1 and 2. The second one is, we're kind of in the middle of this one actually, so this is chapters 3 through 5. And kind of the common theme here is that they move from judgment to restoration in each of these three sermons. So you can kind of divide up the book into these three large units. I think that's kind of an easy way to think about it, and a lot of the outlines that you see out there are kind of modeled around this structure. One of the reasons that we divide it this way is because we see patterns in the scripture, so it kind of makes sense from that perspective. And this really, you know, centers on that structure of judgment to restoration, hope, and salvation in each of these three sermons. So as we begin chapter 4, we're actually kind of in the middle of the second sermon, which actually began in chapter 3. So chapter 3 is kind of the message of devastation and judgment. And chapter 3 kind of leads us in that devastation, both of the leadership and by God, who's going to kind of devastate the people through his judgment, that the people are you know, devastating in the way that they're acting to the people. And so, you know, just to kind of talk a little bit about chapter 3 before moving to 4, it's you know, Micah is denouncing the leaders, which is mainly the heads of Jacob, the priests, and the prophets, for very specific sins. So what are some examples of that, those sins that you saw in chapter 3 in the previous class? What are some of the ones, you know, that really jumped out to you that were shocking, maybe, or that kind of hit home for you?
It seems to be some of the rulers taking advantage of the people.
Yeah.
Injustice and maybe abusing their positions.
Yeah, seems like they take every opportunity they can to take advantage of the people, you know, taking their inheritance or even taking the robe off somebody's back. I think it says in one of the verses. Any others that jumped out to you?
Just general corruption. I mean, there in verse 11, it talks about giving judgment for a bribe or teaching for a price or practicing divination for money. They were willing to do, you know, anything for money, no matter what truth that changed, and that's definitely corrupt.
Yeah, it seems all very selfishly motivated. I think they're all kind of looking out for themselves and, you know, catching each other in nets. So the heads of Jacob, we read that their greed is compared to cannibals tearing the skins off people in the very beginning of that chapter. They detest justice and make crooked all that is straight. They're given to bribes. The priests, likewise, they're teaching for a price. So they're solely teaching for financial gain in that chapter. The prophets, their message of war or peace is dependent solely on their physical circumstances at the time, and whether it says whether or not their stomachs are full. The prophets practice divination only for a financial reward, and yet I think it's kind of ironic in chapter 3, verse 11, it says, kind of in an arrogant way, they can't imagine that disaster is going to come upon them, because surely God must be on their side. And so the consequences are pretty clear in that chapter. The Lord is going to hide himself from the people and no longer provide answers to them. There's no longer going to be visions for the prophets. Zion is going to be plowed into a field in verse 12 of chapter 3. And Jerusalem is going to become a heap of ruins. And then as we move into this chapter, we're going to see exaltation and restoration of the people. So there's going to be a pretty stark contrast between that chapter and 4 and 5. God is going to teach his ways to all the nations. The mountain of the house of the Lord, that's going to be established in the beginning of chapter 4. And God is going to be the ultimate judge of the people. And there's no longer going to be war. He's going to redeem his people. And he's going to redeem the lame and afflicted. And he's going to rescue his people from Babylon. And ultimately, he's going to show the world his universal rule. He will use this time of war and captivity as a harvest, where the Lord is going to trample out the enemy into the dust. And then chapter 5, we're going to see more messages of restoration. God is going to raise up a shepherd from Bethlehem, and he's going to destroy all the, not only the weapons that the people have in their strongholds, but he's also going to destroy the idols and the idolatry from the people. This is another kind of another way to look at the book. I'm not going to spend too much time on this, but you can kind of divide it up between two cycles of doom, hope, or kind of the way that we're looking at it at the bottom is these three separate sermons. Okay, so let's start in the text. Starting in verse 1 of chapter 4. It shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established as the highest of the mountains, and it shall be lifted up above the hills, and the people shall flow to it. And many nations shall come and say, Come, let us go to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, and we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. So, up to this point, we've seen lots and lots of judgment. Obviously, it's shifting here as we read about the mountain of the house of the Lord. And we read a little bit about the judgment of Samaria. That was kind of in chapter 1, but we're not reading about that later in this book. So we believe that these sermons are probably more likely during the time of Ahaz and Hezekiah. This idea of a mountain, chapter 1, the judgment of the Lord is kind of compared to the mountains which are going to melt under him, and the valleys are going to split open like a wax, like wax before him. And chapter 1, the Lord comes from his holy temple, which is heaven, to judge the people in a very dramatic way. So there's going to be chaos on earth brought about by the sin of man in that chapter. So that's one example that we see in this book so far of mountains. So that's kind of a more dramatic view of judgment from that chapter. And then at the very end of chapter 3, we see the Lord's judgment come upon Jerusalem, which is going to become like a heap of ruins. And the temple, which stood on Mount Zion, would be completely destroyed, as well as the house of the mountain of the house, which is the temple, is going to become like a wooded height or a forest. And so there's kind of a contrast here. I guess what I'm trying to get at is these images so far of mountains have been kind of negative in light, and had to do with judgment. And then in contrast, we're going to see this mountain of the house of the Lord. In the first few chapters, we see the Lord coming down to melt the mountains and bring destruction upon Mount Zion. And here we're comparing that to the mountain of the house of the Lord, which is a place of peace and stability and wisdom. What are some of the consequences that we've seen so far of, you know, from the people committing all these sins that we've read about? What are some of the, you know, we see a lot of examples of sin in chapter 1 and 2 and 3, and what are some of the examples of or verses that you've seen of things that are going to happen to the people, the consequences because of that?
Destruction of Samaria.
Right, yeah.
And the carrying away of the Babylon.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Samaria's going to become a pile of rubble. Says that in chapter 1, and God is going to allot their land to an apostate in chapter 2, and people are no longer going to have an inheritance. In chapter 3, it says the Lord is going to hide himself from the people, and he's no longer going to provide them with answers. There's no longer going to be visions for the prophets, and in Zion as well is going to be plowed into a field, and Jerusalem is going to become a heap of ruins. And while the majority of the text at this point has been on judgment, there's also a glimpse, a little bit of a glimpse that we've seen so far, to that divine promise to eventually gather together Jacob as a remnant. And that was at the very end of chapter 2. It says that the Lord, will gather the remnant like sheep in a pasture, and the Lord is going to lead them in their return to the land. And so kind of getting back to this mountain of the house of the Lord, what do we learn about the mountain of the house of the Lord in these verses? What is the value that we see here? How is it going to impact these people and other nations as well? Is there anything that you see there?
There is a measure of attraction here, so the people will flow into it. You know, so it's highlighted, it's visible, it's prominent, if you will. Stands out, maybe a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That same kind of image is used frequently of God's people. And the mountain or Zion kind of is more representative figuratively of people, it's called a mountain, but really it's a little hill on the southeast corner of Jerusalem, basically, mm-hmm. is all it really is. But it's frequently referred to as a mountain because of its prominence in God's eyes, or where Jerusalem or the city of David would have been built. So it's to me, it speaks of the attraction of God's people. It pulls people to it.
Yeah, I like that idea of people kind of being attracted to it and flowing to it, in contrast to them being attracted and flowing to all the idols that are out there as well. So the people are going to look to this mountain in the latter days, and this idea of the latter days, it's often used by the prophets to point to the time of the Messiah when we're under rule of a new king and outside of the old law. Is there a comment?
I was going to ask you what this messianic.
Is this a, what was the question again?
Is he talking about the establishment of the church?
I think that he's talking about the establishment of the eternal kingdom and the church as well. I think it's probably... is there any other thoughts on...
Is he saying in the latter days?
Yeah, I kind of see it as both. I see it as the church and his eternal kingdom in heaven.
Latter days frequently just refers to judgment. You know, whether it's Revelation, Ezekiel, or Isaiah, it speaks of God's judgment, which Micah is talking about. But there's this remnant that God is going to preserve with God's people. It's through that remnant that the Messiah will come. In chapter 5, they'll talk about that for him. So it is kind of a twofold. One is, I'm gonna preserve you. You will be judged by me for the wickedness and all the sins that you've committed. So there is this judgment that's coming.
Mm-hmm.
But the latter part of all of that, I will preserve that remnant of the promise that I made to Abraham so many years ago. I'm going to preserve that. I'm going to keep my promise. And eventually that promise will be fulfilled in more of a messianic way.
So this is twofold?
Can be. The answer is kind of.
Relative to this phrase about the house of the Lord, when we look in some of the latter prophets after the captivity, one of the things we see is that God's only ever had one house, and that's the place where he meets his people. And so when they rebuild the temple after it's destroyed years from now, God's going to make this kind of amazing statement that you see this house before and now you see it now, but that's nothing like what it's going to be in the future. And physically, it's two different physical temples in Jerusalem and then the church in the New Testament time. But God has referred to it as a single house, you know, the house before, the house during, the house to come. And so when you see this phrase here about the mountain of the house of the Lord, it's kind of interesting. We know it has something to do with the church. We know it has something to do with where God's going to meet man, and it could have a short-term meaning in terms of, you know, when they rebuild the temple after the captivity. Could mean a lot of things, but the house of the Lord always means where God meets with his children.
And I think latter days can be thought of as like a turning point in history, if you will. So there's this defining moment, and one of that is the judgment, Jerusalem falling, Babylonian, Assyrian, all those things are turning points in history. The ultimate turning point
is the establishment of his kingdom, the people of God.
Right, right.
If you think about how he ended chapter 3, that all these enemies climbed up and turned over. But their arrogance, such as, this is our God, he's delivered us through these past years past. We're indestructible. Those things will be turned over, but this will be internal. This is what he's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
This is
mm-hmm.
what he's pointing to.
Yeah, yeah.
This is the power of God. It can't be overcome. This kingdom.
Yeah.
This passage is also in Isaiah
2.
In Isaiah 2:1, it says, the word that Isaiah son of Amos saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. And so, although we could take Judah and Jerusalem figuratively also, and it probably, again, is that dual thing, but I think you can also see Judah and Jerusalem in a more direct way throughout the passage, too, when you talk about the law going forth, you know, and he will judge between the nations. That, you know, that sounds like Jesus teaching on the mountain and him, you know, talking about separating sheep from goats and things like that. So definitely it looks like there's that physical law came forth from Jerusalem is included in there for sure. Like it's not only the big people, like long term.
Yeah, no. Okay. Yeah, good comments.
One of those wonderful passages is just rich in symbolism. Probably read a lot more into it than we need to sometimes, but also maybe take a look at that word mountain. You know, we've talked about the latter days in the house, but the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established at the highest of the mountain. That's not figuratively talking about the mountain in the city of Jerusalem, because that mountain's not getting any higher. So that has to be looking forward now to, you know, what's going to come at the time of the Messiah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and we know that kingdom that God establishes, it's going to be established forever, and it's never going to be destroyed. A couple of examples of that are Daniel chapter 7, verse 14. It says, "His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed." And Hebrews chapter 12, verse 28, it says, "Therefore, let us be grateful for receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, and thus let us offer to God acceptable worship with reverence and awe." And so, yeah, I think those are some really good comments. I think this is kind of pointing to that kingdom that's going to be established here on earth, that's going to be here for eternity, because we're a part of it, and our souls are eternal in that regard. So in contrast to all the corruption, injustice, and evil that has been pointed out in the prior chapters, this mountain is going to be a source of instruction and justice and righteousness. And he's going to, as we see in verse 2, he's going to teach us his ways, and out of Zion shall go forth the law. And I think that this is kind of pointing also to the blessing is not going to be limited to just the Jewish nation, but it's going to, all people are going to flow to this mountain for guidance and wisdom. So that kind of points to the current age where salvation is offered to all man through Christ. Any other comments on this section before we move? Okay, let's read the next few verses here. "He shall judge between many peoples and shall decide disputes for strong nations far away. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation. Neither shall they learn of war anymore. But they shall sit every man under his vine, under his fig tree, and no one shall make them afraid. For the mouth of the Lord of hosts is spoken. For all the peoples walk each in the name of its God, but we will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever." And so I want to ask the question, what does this verse mean about people beating their swords into plowshares and spears into pruning hooks? Does this mean that God's people are going to go from being warriors to farmers, or does it have a more, you know, any other significant meaning to it? And just, you know, kind of while you're thinking about that, here's a few pictures. Here's one of a couple of swords on the left and spears on the left, and on the right is plowshares and pruning hooks. Here's a drawing of a plow, and a plowshare is actually the blade at the very bottom of it. So what are your thoughts on this? What does this mean?
Well, for a long time I have thought, to me, that is making a spiritual reference to the only place that there really is peace is in the kingdom of the Lord. And we don't need weapons of the earth for that purpose. And the only place we're going to find real peace is within ourselves and among each other, and as we live and work or whatever. So, I mean, that's sort of, I'm not sure I'm expressing it very well, but it speaks to me of the peace as opposed to war, which goes on in the world. People are at each other's throats, et cetera, et cetera. Christians are learning a whole new way that Jesus taught.
Right, right, yeah, so, yeah, that's very... It's a good comment, yeah. God, he's the one that offers peace to
yeah,
us.
He came to bring peace among men in whom he is well pleased. You know, as the angels.
Yeah, that's a good comment. So God is going to be the ultimate judge in this time of peace. I think that his eternal kingdom in heaven is not going to be established or defended by any kind of man-made weapons. So these swords and these spears are no longer going to be needed, because there's no longer going to be war in Zion. So the people are better served by repurposing their weapons into kind of like farming equipment, I guess you could say. And these swords and spears are used in times of war and destruction and physical death. But in contrast, these plows and hooks are typically used in times of peace or growth and life. So any more thoughts on that?
It has a double meaning. I mean, it can apply in two ways. Earthly for the Jews at that time, coming back as a remnant. Or do you think so? And then spiritually.
Which verse?
Of peace. Well, just in general, what we're talking about. That they won't need these weapons anymore.
God has given them peace.
And that's what he gives us in the kingdom.
Right, right. I mean, that's okay. No,
that's
good. Good
comment. To me, it seems like it's more about the spiritual, because when they come back to build the wall, what are they holding? Swords.
Right.
So they're not going to have, like, perfect peace in Jerusalem anymore. But the idea that it says, and he will judge between the people and rebuke strong nations afar off. So it sounds like maybe when Christ comes and rebukes those who are wrong and points out what's wrong and makes his judgment, then it's no longer going to be on us to judge and to yield swords, but we're going to be cultivators at that point because he's already made the judgment.
Yeah, no, I think it's a good song.
So, first of all, I appreciate the reference to agricultural equipment again. This is really good. But one of the things, you know, if we tie this back to the previous verses to think about, these verses are looking ahead to the time of Christ, the time of the church. As we look through the Old Testament, we see God moving in the nations and using one nation to judge another and one nation to punish another and to punish the Israelites and to punish, you know, a lot of punishing going on back and forth, and there's prophecies about what's going to happen with these nations in Daniel and Ezekiel and other places, and it takes us up to about the time of Christ. But after the time of Christ, what we see is that the warfare going on is not this physical warfare. You don't see, after the time of Christ, God talking about prophecies of nations rising and falling. You just don't see that because it's no longer relevant to the discussion that we're having. You know, from the time when the people of Israel were being trained and becoming a nation and God was fulfilling his promises to them, after the perfect fulfillment in Christ, there just isn't that discussion. So it also could be looking forward to that time where the issues of physical war are not relevant to God's people. Today, you know, do we participate in wars as a part of God's executing God's judgment on other nations? No, it's nothing to do with what we have today.
Yeah, that was a good point. Actually, I have a good verse to kind of follow that comment up, which is a very good comment. John 18:36, it says, Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting in it, that I might not be delivered over to the Jews. But my kingdom is not from the world." And it's kind of ironic that in this book, we're also seeing prophecy that their enemies are going to overtake them with, you know, similar weapons of swords as God executes his judgment on them, and yet there's going to be a time of peace. So there's kind of this difference there, but I think it kind of points more to spiritual peace that's going to happen for God's church and kind of that eternal peace in heaven as well. So we're not going to need weapons of war any longer to, you know, because they're not going to be required to defend from the threats in God's eternal kingdom of peace, which I think Jesus kind of pointed to in that verse. So the old Zion that we kind of talked about a minute ago, it wasn't the eternal kingdom. Obviously, it was temporary and it was subject to decay and destruction, like everything else in this world. But this new kingdom is going to be spiritual in nature, and it's never going to be destroyed. And then, so kind of moving on to verse 4, where we hear a little bit about the vine and the fig tree. I'll kind of go back to that one and read it real quick. But be thinking about what exactly do you think that means? It says in verse 4, "But they shall sit every man under his vine and under his fig tree. No one shall make them afraid, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken." So what exactly do you take that to mean exactly? Yeah, it sounds like a positive thing, right?
Seems to continue that theme of cultivation instead of battle.
Yeah, so if we kind of think about Jonah at the very end of that book, Jonah was sitting under the vine, which God provided him a shelter from the elements, so that's kind of one positive view, but it's also a key image of fruitful prosperity that we see in the Old Testament. A couple of examples of that are 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 25, it says, "And Judah and Israel lived in safety from Dan even to Beersheba, every man under his vine and under his fig tree all the days of Solomon." And Zechariah 3:10 says, "In that day, declares the Lord of hosts, every one of you will invite his neighbor to come under his vine and under his fig tree." So I think this is just kind of a positive view of peace and shelter and prosperity. So then moving on to this expression of the Lord of hosts in verse 4, I think this is kind of like a military title from what I understand. It kind of emphasizes God's strength and his authority and his sovereignty to make all the things that he's mentioning happen. And then in verse 5, we see kind of a comparison between Yahweh God versus the little g gods, and we understand that there's all kinds of gods for these people to be able to worship, but only those who wish to inherit the promises that we read about in this section are to walk in the name of Yahweh God. Any more comments before we move on to the next section? Text? Okay, let's continue reading in verse 6. It says, "In that day, declares the Lord, I will assemble the lame and gather those who have been driven away and those who I have afflicted. And the lame I will make a remnant, and those who are cast off a strong nation. And the Lord will reign over them in Mount Zion from this time forth and forevermore. And you, O tower of the flock, hill of the daughter of Zion, to you shall it come, the former dominion shall come, kingship for the daughter of Jerusalem." And so I think that, you know, he's talking a little bit about the lame and afflicted here, and I think that we read a lot about these people in the previous couple of chapters. These are the people that have suffered because of the sins of the leaders, those being the heads of Jacob, the priests, the prophets, and those who are not able to speak up or defend themselves, or, you know, people that don't have any kind of advocate for themselves in any way. So a couple of examples of that. In chapter 2, these leaders, they covet fields and seize them. They oppress a man in his house and take his inheritance as well. It says that they strip the rich robe from those who pass by trustingly. Chapter 2, verse 9, it says, the women you drive out from their delightful houses, from their young children you take away my splendor forever. So I think these are the kind of people that are the lame and afflicted that are being kind of gathered as a remnant at this time. And then in verse 7, we again see that the remnant is going to be preserved. God is just, and he's not only going to make all things right as the eternal judge, but he's going to make things right for this remnant on this earth as he preserves that remnant. And there's many times that the word remnant, it refers to those who return from captivity, and at other times it kind of has a messianic and New Testament application for those people who are going to follow Jesus as Lord. So if you remember from Romans chapter 11, starting in verse 1, it says, and I'll try to kind of summarize this because it's verses 1 through 7, it says, and I ask, then, has God rejected his people? By no means. And then it says, these are the people whom he foreknew. He has not rejected them. And then it gives the example of Elijah. Elijah says, Lord, they have killed your prophets, they have demolished your altars, and I alone am left, and they seek my life. But what does God's reply to him? I have kept for myself 7,000 men who have not bowed the knee to Baal. And so it says in verse 5, so too, at the present time, there is a remnant chosen by grace. So I think that's referring to us as a church. We're kind of a version of that remnant as well. And so there's many people that depart that we'll see in this book, but the remnant is the one that holds on. Romans 11:20, it says, they were broken off because of their unbelief, but you stand fast through faith. So do not become proud of fear. Okay, well, we can pick up where we left off in the next class.
See, I'm not working the summer, so I can kind of...